I'd like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to speak in this symposium today. I'm going to talk about invasive species, classical biological control, conservation, and trade-offs. It's a little bit different than the title that I originally submitted, but I think this more accurately reflects the content of my presentation. I'd also like to acknowledge my co-author, Michael Samways, who's an insect conservation biologist at the University of Stellenbosch in South Africa. And he sort of serves as a counterpoint to many of my positions in classical biological control. I also want to thank my friends for staying to the very end of the day, and I guess it's better being the last talk on the first day than the first talk on the last day. I was asked to talk about the role of biological control in regulating and managing invasive species, and to provide some thoughts and perspectives on current and future directions in the management of exotic pests. And I like the picture, that's why I keep bringing it up. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a look at invasive species and particularly focus on classical biological control. And I want to use sort of a conservation framework to serve as an environmental litmus test for evaluating potential benefits and costs, and then have some final thoughts on possible future directions. We're all very well aware of the importance and impact of invasive species. It's been estimated that they perhaps account for up to 5% of the global economy. And in the United States, we've seen the figure of $120 billion a year, and this is a figure that's already 8 or 9 years old. But there are really no good estimates of the impact of these invasive species in natural systems. Upwards of 50,000 invasive species are reported for the United States. Half of them are plants, 40% are microbes, and 9% are arthropods. And just over 40% of the nearly 1,000 species listed as threatened or endangered are at risk because of invasive species. So invasive species are indeed a problem. But we also know that biological control has had tremendous impact. There are over 200 known fully successful programs and multiples of substantially and partially successful programs. It's been estimated that biological control has been applied to more than 350 million hectares worldwide. We're talking about 10% of the land on the earth under cultivation. And that the cost-benefit ratio has been estimated as anywhere from 1 to 20 to 1 in 500. More than 2,000 natural enemies have been released, and 165 pest species have been permanently reduced. And as Ann pointed out, more than 5,000 introductions have been made in 196 countries or islands around the world. So we know that biological control also can have a big impact. So what are the conservation concerns? There are four major concerns for conservation biology. One is habitat loss. Invasive species, and here we have a picture of emerald ash borer, but sometimes our friends also become identified as invasive species, as this Harmonia exiridis. Environmental contamination is a third concern, and a fourth major concern is indeed biological control. Here's a picture of Vespasia archipovora, which is a tachinid fly known to attack 25 species of Lepidopteran pests and at least one hymenopteran species in North America, and for some reason it was released as a biocontrol agent into Hawaii in the 19th century and had consequential impact on non-target species. But sometimes classical biological control is really the best and only option for truly sensitive conservation targets. Weeds are the most common target, and there have been well over 80 terrestrial weed species that have been the target of classical biological control programs. We're well aware of the Opuntia cactus project in Australia. We've heard about Klamath weed and familiar with the current big project in the West on salt cedar, but there are many other examples as well. There are fewer but equally important examples in the aquatic system, and probably the best known worldwide is the work on water hyacinths. There are many fewer known targets, known projects for plant herbivores. In the Caribbean, a Bermuda cedar was under threat from a couple of exotic scale plants, and about 20 years ago, 8 different species of coccinellids have been released against the scale. It's still unclear what impact they're having, but we do know that the Bermuda cedar still exists and hasn't gone extinct. And there are even fewer projects targeting arthropod predators or parasites. Perhaps the best known is the red fire ant, and it's a parasitoid, this forage fly. So what's the tension all about? What are the concerns that the conservation community has about biological control? Well, there are some problems with our priorities. There are some, we're at odds in some areas. In the classical biological control arena, most of our demand comes from the agricultural community, so we're driven primarily by economic considerations. But there are also times when, when social considerations can be important, particularly if you're considering cultural phenomena that might be particularly endangered by a pest, for example, the copra culture in Fiji at the turn of last century, which was threatened by the coconut moth, or talk about issues such as humanitarian assistance and food security, a major problem of a primary source of protein or carbohydrates, and I'm going to talk about a project that I was involved in Africa. But there are other considerations as well. I mean, the concern is that these introductions are permanent, they're irreversible, and that we're unable to predict with certainty a future impact. So let's take a look at what the costs of classical biological control are. Well, the risks include a well-known litany of concerns that have been raised: non-target impacts on host and prey, changes in food web, intraguild predation, competitive displacement, host shift, range expansion, possibility of invasion into new habitats or disease vectors. But there are also equal number of benefits that offset many of those risks, including the fact that it's a natural intervention. The impact can indeed be spectacular, can be ecologically targeted and environmentally compatible when properly implemented, can help reduce production costs, increase economic value, and very clear social justifications under some circumstances. So the question is there a place for classical biological control in addressing the threat of invasive species? And I'll make the contention that it's really a question of trade-offs. What are we willing to give up for what we're willing to gain? So my co-author and I have come up with this sort of very simple contingency table where you look at classical biological control values in terms of high value, low value, versus conservation value, high value versus low value. And what you'd like to have is a situation where everything falls in this first quadrant, where it's appropriate for classical biological control. That's a high value for the intervention and low risk for conservation. And it all means you want to avoid a situation where you have no or low conservation value and high risk. This would be indeed inappropriate for classical biological control. In this quadrant, you may not have enough value to pursue classical biological control. And in this case, you need to reevaluate if the classical biological control value could be improved. And here, you may have enough classical biological control impact, but there may be concerns about the impact on conservation. In other words, the risk would be high. So here again, you'd want to reevaluate to see if you could find a way to minimize the risk to the conservation concerns. If we take a look at this simple table in a historical context, we get an idea of where we've been with many of our previous biocontrol programs. Most of them have indeed been in agricultural production systems, and most have been successful. And these have been largely because of rather specialized arthropod predators, and a good example is the Vidalia beetle. Where we've seen most of the problems have been the typical non-arthropod predators, vertebrate agents like mammals, fish and toads, generalist predators like snail predators, and targets such as islands or threatened species or endangered habitats, where there has been some indications that extinctions have occurred. This is the quadrant where we probably find most of our unsuccessful classical biological control. but there's no or little evidence of negative conservation consequences. Whereas in this quadrant, there's quite a few examples of generalist arthropod agents, for example, some parasitoids like braconids and tachinids, and some predators like coccinellids and ants, and some herbivores like weevils and caterpillars, which have more than the specific narrow target impact that one would like to hope in. And I'm not sure where the pathogens would go in here, but this is something that perhaps could be added. So from a conservation perspective, what they're looking for in this simple model is they would like to see natural enemies with a rather narrow host range, limited impact on food web, but they would be supportive of anything that would reduce pesticide impact and anything that would help preserve threatened species or habitats. Absolutely nothing that would have non-target impacts or ecosystem impacts, and it's anything that would move into new habitats or lead to habitat loss. And doing nothing, of course, is not an option, especially when you're talking about very sensitive conservation systems. This would be a circumstance where the conservation value might be high, but the biological control value would be low. You have low spread, limited distribution, and little target impact. And here, a concern might be you get your primary target controlled, and that would lead to sort of a cascading pest problem, so the next pest would move in. Or there's also always concern about the possible vectoring of pathogens with your natural enemies. So what would we be looking for if we wanted to identify the kinds of attributes for our biocontrol agents that would be appropriate? Well, under this scenario, obviously, specialists that are efficacious but have a reduced apparent competition and would be involved in the simplest possible food webs. And of course, avoiding at all costs the generalists, the vertebrate agents, any new associations, and anything that would substantially change the food web. In this scenario, you might find predators that are not very efficacious. They probably wouldn't become established or spread very much, have little or no impact on the target, and minimal food web impact. But this might be a good target for or consideration of use of augmentation or conservation biological control. Whereas in this scenario, you would be looking for natural enemies that are persistent, reoccur seasonally, would spread and distribute, and they may have some complex food web interaction. So from a conservation point of view, this would not be ideal. But there may in fact be economic or social imperatives for considering this sort of a situation. So taking these examples, where might you modify or improve the actions that you would take to implement a classical biological control program? Well, the bottom line is you're trying to increase the reward that you get from the classical biological intervention and decrease the conservation cost. And the way you're going to do that is by increasing your understanding and predictability of the classical biological control value and the conservation risks that would be associated with the potential natural enemies being considered. And of course, this is going to require much more knowledge about basic biology, ecology, and ecosystem interactions than we have today. And in fact, until we know much more about these systems, the strategic research needs are going to continue to be met on a case-by-case basis. In other words, there's no single silver bullet that we're going to be able to come up with. If you're trying to increase the potential value of your classical biological control agent, you're going to want to be working on predators that have, and parasitoids that have high persistence, ability to spread, those that are involved in simple food webs, and have a neutral conservation cost. In other words, you want something that is going to be compatible with the conservation objectives, both as a byproduct and as an expectation of the selection process. If you're looking for greater potential conservation value, you're going to be doing work on host specificity to be sure that you're avoiding non-target and ecosystems impacts. And you want to mitigate against the cascading pest problem. In other words, solving one problem that just leads to another, and of course, avoid vectoring pathogens. But at the end of the day, we have to remember that there are going to be economic and social considerations that could be important, and that many times these decisions are based more on policy and politics than on ecology and conservation. Here in a couple of slides, I'll show you some work that I was involved in Africa. We have a situation where we have an exotic crop that was impacted by an exotic pest. Cassava's been in Africa about 400 years, but it's been about 100 years since it really became an important food crop for well over 200 million people. It's a primary source of carbohydrates for many of these folks, and they grow the cassava primarily for the storage root, but also for the protein value of the leaves. Well, just under 40 years ago, a couple of new pests of cassava arrived, and one of them was the cassava green mite, a tetranychid pest, which devastated the production on the continent. Basically, by feeding on the young leaves, it reduced the ability of the plant to produce photosynthesize and produce photosynthate, which is shunted down to the storage root, causing a reduction in yield of about 30% to 50%. Well, we got involved in a project looking at natural enemies that could be selected, meeting some of the criteria that have been presented in the contingency tables just mentioned. And we ended up screening about 25 species of phytoseed mites, bringing in 11 species for experimental releases, and three of the predators became established and showed promise. One of them became the star of the show. Tifidromalis aripo was first released in Ingpile, Benin, in October of 1993, and it immediately showed promise in terms of its spread. Here we can see in the next figure that this is parts of West Africa. This is Nigeria, Benin, Togo, and Ghana, and within three seasons, it spread over the entire cassava distribution in those countries. So we went back and quickly started distributing the predator throughout the cassava belt, and in some field trials where we looked in farmers' fields at cassava where the predator had been eliminated, those are the yellow bars, versus plants where the predator was present, these are the green bars, we measured an impact of about a third increase in production. And if you look at this in terms of very simple economics, these predators were estimated to add about $120 of additional value per hectare per season in Benin. And when you multiply that up over the cassava belt, it's a number that's very large. I mean, it would cost millions, literally hundreds of millions of dollars to replace that production with food aid. So by all standards, this was a highly successful biological control program, but driven primarily by economic and social concerns. But because of our strategy for selecting host-specific natural enemies, there's no evidence that we've had any negative impact in the environment. That doesn't mean that it's been a positive impact, but we're working in a highly modified system. The host plant is introduced, the pests are introduced, many of the other crops found in the sort of tropical food crop system in Africa are also introduced. So this is a situation where clearly the drivers are not solely economic, or not exclusively environmental. So where to next? Well, invasive species certainly have a place where classical biological control and conservation overlap. But not all invasive species, not all environments, not all natural enemies are suitable or appropriate for classical biological control. And the challenge is going to be to increase the low-value classical biological control agents where conservation risks are low, or to decrease the conservation risks where the classical biological control values are high. And regardless, we're going to have to further evaluate our agents to clarify the classical biological control value and conservation risks for each situation on a case-by-case basis to arrive at a satisfactory conclusion. And this will require a lot more attention, a lot more effort, and a lot more resources than currently available. Thank you.
If you have a question or two quickly, we are running kind of late here.
Yes, you have agreed with everything you said. And the idea of making bio and cold more predictable is something we all want to do. Especially things like changes in the food web can be extremely difficult to predict.
you know, I don't know all the details of that, you know, and I understand that for that, when we talk about the Hata virus, that that may well be an artifact of a recently introduced element to the system. What's it going to be like 5 years from now or 10 years from now? No, we're not going to be able to predict everything. We're not going to be able to know everything. Like I said, it's a question of trade-offs, and oftentimes we'll get to a point where we'll have all the biological information that we can afford to gather. Then the decision is going to end up being one based on policy or politics, and it's, you know, I think from an environmental perspective, for an ecological perspective, it's very easy to take shots at what we do in classical biological control. But if you have a mandate also to solve problems and to address these issues using other criteria that are not strictly environmental in nature, then you have to weigh the whole set of variables. So, you know, this sort of gets on sort of dangerous grounds real quickly with certain communities, and that's one of the reasons I have Michael Samways as my truth-sayer in this. So he'll certainly help keep me honest, but I don't think there's a simple answer to your question.
Thank you, Steve. I'll make a couple of quick comments before we conclude this symposium. I hope you all agree that we had tremendous symposium today, and that has been made possible only by the great speaker, great list of speakers we had today. So let's give a round of applause for all the speakers we had for this symposium. And another, just for those who are not associated with this symposium when you formulated, may want to know that we are attempting to publish this symposium as a supplemental publication. And Dr. James Harwood is leading this effort, and hopefully sometime in the future we will have all these papers presented today here will be published. With that, I would like to have James Harwood, my co-organizer, join me in thanking all the speakers and the audience and the ESA program enhancement funds and all the help we had to put this together. With that, I would like to conclude this symposium. Thank you, everybody.